don't do no more. The things I used to do, I don't do no more. The things I used to do, I don't do no more. For the Lord's made a change in me.
This is Real History with Melissa, and today is the 17th of April, 2025. In April of 2023, I got a short message from my friend Judy, and with just a question, really, asking if I knew of a town called Pioneer, Texas. And I wrote her back and said, no, I'd never heard of that. And later, maybe that same day or shortly after that, she said, so you've never heard of Pioneer, Texas? No. Why? Well, I had a dream. I was with my mother, and Alan was visiting with us. And he said that he couldn't stay long with us because he was on his way to Pioneer, Texas, and he was going to be there for 3 days. I said, oh, that's a strange dream. Now, I don't know what was going on with me in April of 2023, because I might have paid just a little bit more attention to that or asked a question or two about the details of the dream, because Judy is, she's definitely intuitive, and I don't want to give away any confidences, but I have experienced both with Alan and also with myself that she can pick up things from many, many miles away and kind of maybe knows when you need something. Knows when maybe there's something going on, and she'll just reach out. But I simply told her, nope, I've never heard of Pioneer, Texas. Late last month, I think it might have been about the 30th of March, this topic came up again with Judy 2 years later. She said, you remember that dream I told you about? And I'm like, which dream? She said, you know, the one about Pioneer, Texas. I said, oh, yeah, yeah. And she said, well, I never told you the whole dream, all of the dream. And I said, well, take me through the dream again. And so she did in great detail. Her mother was at the kitchen table. There were a lot of tools and things on the table, like Alan might have, like he had brought some things with him, and he was giving a demonstration of something to Judy's mother. And Judy was in the kitchen, but there was a pass-through window or something between there and the dining room table where her mother was. So Judy could see over the top of her mother's head and look directly at Alan. And Alan said to both Judy and her mother, I can't stay long. I have to go to Pioneer, Texas, and I'll be there for 3 days. And so Judy had told me that before, and she said, well, the part that I didn't tell you was that Alan said, it's a very, very small town with two buildings in it, a church and a community center. It's a very small town with two buildings in it. And Judy said, oh, okay. And then the dream ended. And Judy said that she looked up the town online and saw that it was a town with two buildings in it, and it also had a cemetery. It's Pioneer, Texas, with a church and a community center and the Pioneer Cemetery. So when Judy told me that, I said, okay, this is a road trip. I have to go to Pioneer, Texas. And she said, really? I said, yeah, absolutely. Because as it turned out, and Judy knew this 2 years ago when she had the dream and looked it up, it's just a straight shot from me. I think it said that I was going to get there in about, I don't know, two hours. It took me longer to get there than the map said that it would, but I was there in about, I think, about 2 hours. Two and a half hours, actually. That's what it was. I thought I'd be there in under 2 hours, but it took about 2.5 hours. So I looked it up, and I said, yeah, this has got to be a road trip, because it's a straight shot west from me. And according to the map, I was going to be able to be there in under 2 hours. So I said, yeah, I'm going. And Judy said, really? What, you know, you'll have to do that sometime. I said, no, I'm going. This is a road trip. I am going on shortly, as soon as I can. So I had, what was the 30th of March? So I had the 30th of March when we were speaking was a Sunday, and I was completing uploading, and there was something happening on Monday. On Monday the 31st, there was a reason why I felt that the soonest I could go was the 2nd of April, Wednesday the 2nd of April. So I said, I'm going. And she said, wow. I said, yeah, absolutely. I'm going to get in the car and go to Pioneer. Well, the day before, on the 1st, on April 1st, I got a little April Fool's. I went down to my brother's office where I put together book orders, and I had a book to print up and take to the post office. And so I went inside and I made up the book, and then when I went back out to my car, the car threatened not to start. And at this point, I was completely psyched up. I was going to Pioneer, Texas the next day. Now, it was 12 minutes after 4 on Tuesday afternoon, and the post office closes at 4:30. The mechanic is a block in one direction, and the post office is a block in the other direction. And I said, no, I'm going to the mechanic. So I drove the block, I did get the car to start, but it took me like 3 or 4 tries to get it started. Got it to start, drove over to the mechanic, got out and said, I'm going on a road trip tomorrow and the car just threatened not to start. I know the battery is newish, maybe, you know, 2.5 years old. That can't be what's wrong. Could you just check it real quickly for me? And also, while you're at it, just check all the fluids, because I want to make sure that I'm good to go. I told him, I said, I'm going not that much further than Stephenville, because, you know, that'll tell him about where I'm headed. I got the book package out of the car, and I walked really quickly the 2 blocks to the post office, and I made the deadline. And then I walked back to the mechanic, and he'd already checked it out, and he said, the battery's fine, there's no corrosion, check the alternator, blah, blah, blah. He ran through everything, and we checked all the fluids, everything is great, and it's starting just fine now. So, frankly, I think you're ready for your road trip. So I got up early the next morning, and I had my bottled water in the car, and I was ready to go. Oh, but I'll back up. The night before I was leaving, I thought it would be a good idea if I told my brother where I was headed. And so I said, I'm going on a little bit of an adventure tomorrow. And he said, oh, really? What are you doing? And I hesitated, and he goes, well, you don't have to tell me. Everybody's entitled to their little secrets. And I said, no, no, I'll tell you. I said, Judy had a dream. And I told him about Judy's dream. And I said, so I'm going to Pioneer. And I told him there was the Ben Hogan Museum? There was a town called Dublin on the way. I said, there are these different things I may or may not stop at, but my destination is Pioneer. So he said, okay. So I got up in the morning and I drove to Pioneer. And it was uneventful. It was a pretty drive. I'm headed west. and the towns get further apart, it becomes less hilly and less tree-filled and a little more open and barren. Still some hills, that's the topography. And I realize after about, you know, an hour and 50 minutes that I see how much further I have to go. I stopped at a gas station and, you know, I saw how much further I had to go. And I thought, well, this is going to be at least a 2.5 hour drive. And that's about what it took me. So when I have supposedly, according to the map, arrived at my destination, I come to this place where I turned right. And as I'm turning right, they're the only two landmarks, and I didn't take a picture of them, but what you've got there are two trailers on two different lots right next door to each other that have just, it looks like they've been hit by a tornado. It's just debris, you know, where a trailer was, and the trailer's all, you know, caved in, and there was just garbage and just garbage there. And there was also a roof, again, like, it was like something out of Wizard of Oz. It just, a roof there, and all this debris and trash. So I drove past that, and then I see what I think are the landmarks of this little town. To my left, there was a church, and to my right, there was a little building. But I had gone online, and I had seen what the Church of Pioneer looked like, and I had seen the community center. And neither of these buildings looked like what I expected them to look like. Yes, the church was white, as the church in the online was, but other than being white, it just didn't look the same. But I pulled in, and I saw that a sign that said, "Welcome, Pioneer Baptist Church." And so I parked in the parking lot of this little church, and I got out of my car, and I walked up, and it was a real modest church, and not the greatest shape, but it was obviously a church that somebody went to sometime. There was also a little carport, covered carport with a van in the front. And I got up to the front of the door and I saw a sign. I took a picture of the sign and I'll share it with you. And I thought, oh, this is a great way to start my little adventure. The sign on the church said, "Today is a gift from God. That's why it's called the present." And some of you might have heard that before, but I liked that. And so then I took a picture of the building across the street that looked nothing like what I was expecting it to look like. And I walked over to the covered, there was like a little house and house carport. It didn't really look like anybody lived in there, that was part of the church compound. And I'm like, this doesn't seem right. I wouldn't call it super rundown, but also not the best shape. And then the little carport with the van in the front, a white van that said Pioneer Baptist Church on the side of the van. Walked across, looked at the community center, and I was stymied. I felt that I had taken a wrong turn somewhere, and yet this said Pioneer. So I drove down the street, I passed two houses, and on the third house, they had a drive that was covered, you know, kind of a humble house, but it had a covered arch that you would drive through to get to the house. And so I didn't drive through into the, you know, their property. I just pulled off the main road onto the driveway there. And I'm looking at the map and I'm thinking, where did I go wrong? What did I do? And a man, I'd say he was probably in about his mid-40s, kind of stocky built, not super tall, not short, but medium height, walked out from the property over to my car. And I rolled the window down. And he said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "I maybe so. I'm looking for the town of Pioneer, and it's got two buildings in it, a community center and a church, and then there's the Pioneer Cemetery." And I followed the directions, but this doesn't look right. And he just gave me a kind of an odd look, and he said his name. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about names in Pioneer, but I'm going to make up some names here. So the names that I give you are not the real names. So he said, "What is your name?" And I said, "Melissa." And he said, "What's your last name?" So I told him, and he said, "Well, I'm Roy Smith." I said, "Oh, okay. Well, it's nice to meet you, Roy." And I said, "So I'm looking for Pioneer, and I've missed the boat somehow." And he said, "Well, I just got to ask you, nobody ever, and I grew up here, comes looking for Pioneer, Texas. Why are you looking for Pioneer?" And I said, "Well, this is a strange story." And he said, "Well, aren't they all?" I laughed and I said, "Well, okay. My friend had a dream." And I told him the dream. And I said, "My late husband was a bit of a historian. He was a writer. And he was from Scotland, and I lived with him in Canada. And I don't think he was ever in Texas, because he would have told me. He knew I was from Texas. I know that he was in New York, he was in California, he was in Chicago. But if he'd been in Texas, he would have told me." And he said, "Scottish, huh?" And I said, "Yes." And he goes, "My family's Scottish." Like I said, Smith wasn't his last name. And I said, "Really?" And he goes, "Yeah, and we're not Scots-Irish. We're not, you know, Irish, Scottish, English, like so many people are. We're just straight up pure Scottish." I said, "Well, that is really interesting." So we got to talking, and I said, I don't know. I mean, it was a dream, but I thought it warranted a road trip. And so that's what I'm doing. And so he then got out his phone where he had some pictures on it, and he showed me. He said, "Now, when my father was a young man, there were still signs of the oil boom here." But he said, "My grandfather came," and he told me the story about how his grandfather had come to the area during what they called an oil boom. So they were, I think he was talking, I mean, it was crazy. I'm pretty sure he was talking barrels per day. But he said something like, you know, 10,000 barrels a day in the area. And there were, you know, many thousands of people there in this, you know, oil boom in the early 1900s. And let's see, he pointed down the road, and he said his grandmother and grandfather had been there, and they had developed that land, and he told me how many acres had been in the family. And he said he'd moved away twice, and he told me they were both Texas towns that he had gone to, and the last Texas town that he had gone to, my oldest brother lives there. It's not that far from where I am, and I mentioned that. So he said, "But I'm back. I always seem to come back here." And then he said, "Well, have you gone over to Cross Plains yet?" And I said, "No, I don't even know what Cross Plains is." And he said, "Well, Cross Plains is the next town over west from here." And he said, "Now, if you go there," now again, I'm giving you some different last names and so forth, but he said, "Ray Jenkins." He goes, "Is today Wednesday?" I said, "Yes, it is Wednesday." And he said, "Well, you're in luck then, because Ray has the barbershop, but he only opens it one day a week, and that's on Wednesday. And he said, if you go over there, tell him I sent you. And he said he knows the whole history of the area. And anything you want to know about the area, you just ask Ray. I said, okay, that's great. I'll do that. And then I said, well, so where did I go wrong? Why didn't I see the cemetery and the church? I mean, I saw a church. And he goes, well, this isn't really Pioneer. It's like on the edges of it. And, you know, he goes, but what was Pioneer proper? You just go back to that T junction in the road and then turn right. And not that much further up the road, you're going to just run right, and you're going to pass the community center on the right. He goes, although nobody calls it the community center, he goes, that's the ladies' quilting club. And he said, I guess maybe it's a community center, but it's the quilting club. And he said, and then the church is on the other side of the street, and you'll see the cemetery. And he told me a little bit about the cemetery. He said, you know, it's a weird thing. There's a lot of babies there, a lot of little babies and small children buried there. And I said, well, why? Was there some epidemic or something that happened? And he said, no, I don't know why, but there's a lot of babies there. And then he said, well, oh, you know, if you drive down the end there, that was my grandmother's house. And he goes, my mother just passed away about a year ago, and we were going to, you know, fix the place up. We were, you know, actually going to clear the land and tear the old house down because it's kind of a dangerous place now. But, you know, she died, and we just haven't done it. And he said, you're welcome to go down there and walk all over the land. It's my land, and you're welcome to walk it. And see what you can see. It is copperhead season. Now, copperhead is a pretty poisonous snake. So I'm like, what a way to make a really nice invitation and then take it away. And I just had on tennis shoes, you know, and I'm thinking, shoot, I should have had boots and tall ones, you know, for this adventure. But I didn't. So I thanked him, and I said, well, I may come back to your grand folks' house and that land, but I said, the first thing I'm going to do is go to the cemetery, and then I'll go over to Ray's at the barbershop and talk to him. And so that's what I did. I went to the T-junction. I got to back up, though, because I asked him, I said, you know, I read a little bit about Pioneer, and it said that the population was 40 people. And I said, maybe there's more houses when I go up by the cemetery, but I said, I only see like three houses here, and, you know, where do the rest of the people who live in Pioneer live? And he said, well, there's so-and-so down the road. He goes, now, if you want to talk to Teresa, and he gave me her last name, what I'm saying is that this is a really small area, and they probably don't get a lot of outsiders, but everybody knows everybody by first and last name. And so he needed to know my last name. You know, who are you? Who are your people? Where do you come from? And I had told him all that, you know. And so everybody had a first and last name. So he told me Teresa right down the road. He said that, you know, she drives the white Chevy. And if she's home, she knows a lot about the area. But I didn't see a white Chevy, so I assumed that Teresa wasn't home. But I said, so where are the rest of the people in Pioneer? And he goes, well, a lot of them live on the, you know, across the road on the east side. And he goes, I don't keep up with the east side. And I laughed because that's like something a New Yorker would say or something like that. You know, the big city is 40 people. And he laughed too, but he goes, well, I don't, you know, I said, this is my street. This is my area. So I thanked him, and he shook my hand, and he said, I hope you find what you're looking for. I said, well, I have no idea what I'm looking for, but I hope I do too. So I turned around, went back up to the T-junction, turned right, and I went to the cemetery. Now, I'm going to share a lot of pictures of the cemetery because I must have taken about 100 of them. I visited every single grave in that small cemetery. And the very first grave that I looked at was a Watson. And later there was a Watts. I went up one row and down the other and up a row and down the other. And I looked and I, lots and lots and lots of graves of babies and little children. And here's the thing. They were all different years. They weren't all, 1900 or 1880 or, so there's no event that you can say, okay, this is when all these small children died, and they didn't all die at the same age or whatever. Some of them died, obviously, they died when they were, came out, when they were born, they died. And, or didn't live but a few hours, and some of them lived for a day or two, and some of them were a year old, and some of them died in 1880, and some in 1905. But it was very sad, because indeed, the size of the cemetery, which was established in 1879, and there were a lot of veterans' graves there. A lot of military men were buried there. And so the mystery, but here is an interesting thing about it. One of the names, because you get to see who's in this town, who established this town, and one of the big family names of Pioneer were the Pancakes. And I thought that was very interesting, because I'd never heard of Pancake as somebody's last name. But there were a lot of Pancakes who were buried in the Pioneer Cemetery. And Fleming was another name. And so, like I said, I will share a lot of pictures of gravestones, and I just walked around to see what I could see. But again, I really didn't know what I was looking for. So after spending about an hour at the cemetery, I got in my car, and I did find the church, and it was a Pentecostal church. Now, Pentecostal is a kind of church that, I can tell you a little bit more about that later, but it is not a denomination or a kind of church that I see very much of. In fact, I've never seen one in my county. I've never seen a Pentecostal church. I pass a lot of Baptist churches, and there's an Episcopalian church, and there's a couple of Catholic churches, and but not any Pentecostal churches. And so I got out and I took some pictures of the Pentecostal church. So this was Pioneer proper. And then I went over to the so-called community center, or the Ladies Quilting Club, and I went to the front door, which was a screen door that was open, and I took a picture. I'll share that with you, because it's like there's some holes in it, and obviously they had a rat problem, because they had a rat trap, and there were lots of evidence that rats had eaten right through the wall there. And it was a stone. I could peer through the windows. The rest of the building was sealed up pretty well. I didn't see any quilts on the wall or anything like that. It was not the most inviting building that I had ever seen, even if you set aside the rat traps. But there was, it was locked up. The rest of the building was sealed up. So I could peer through and see that, yes, women could gather here. They could have their little social time and bring their quilting supplies in and set it up. There was room for that. And, that was that. And then I drove on to the little town of Cross Plains. Now, Cross Plains, I wouldn't say, it was definitely not big, but it had a main street with some shops on it. And there was a gas station, and there were, so there was activity. There was a lot of activity there, plenty of activity. There were more than 40 people living in Cross Plains. And I was looking for the barber pole, the red and blue stripey thing that you'll see on the old-fashioned barber shops. And I saw it out of the corner of my eye, but I'd already passed the main place where I could turn. And so I pulled off to the side of the road, waiting for the cars to go by so that I could hang a U-turn and go back up the street to the barbershop. And while I was sitting there, there were about three big gas or some kind of flammable liquid, and there were three that came out to cross over onto the main road and turn, and I waited for them, and I didn't see any marking on them, you know, like Exxon or anything like that, but I waited. They went onto the main road, and I hung a U-turn and went up, and I parked as close as I could get to the barbershop. Now, I went into the barbershop. I'm going to share a few pictures of the barbershop so that you can see it. But this is real, real old-timey. And the barber is there. And there were about four men that were chatting and waiting. And my walking in, speaking of the Wizard of Oz, I think it had the effect of like Dorothy and Toto, although I'm too old for Dorothy, so was I Good Witch Glinda? But I'm something that blew in from somewhere else. And I have to say, you know, I'm in my dad's old car. I was wearing a pair of blue jeans, and they were not tight, and they were old. And I was wearing a denim shirt, and it was not new. It was feminine. It wasn't like a guy's denim shirt, but it was nothing fancy. And I was wearing my black tennis shoes and a little black purse that was like no big deal. And my hair was pulled back in a ponytail, and I did not have any makeup on. And I still think the effect was Good Witch Glinda, because these men were like, who is this woman? And that was before I opened my mouth and told them about the dream that Judy had. Now, Judy, and those of you who did not hear the real history that I did with her in 2023, entitled Judy in Disguise with Glasses, you need to get to know Judy. She is as dear a friend as I could ever ask for, and someone that I can talk to on the phone for hours, you know, and if I'm talking for a long time and laughing really hard, my brother just kind of knows it's Judy. And so that's Judy, the dream. But now, back to the barbershop. Here I am in Cross Plains. I walk in, I see all these pictures on the wall of the area and how it looked through time. I could see it at the turn of the last century, not 2000, but 1900. And I could see how it looked in 1930, because there are those cars. And so I saw the horse and buggy days and the 1930s cars. And I'm just taking in all of this. And I'm also seeing all of the oil derricks and the, you know, so whatever Cross Plains was, it isn't that now. So I'm just kind of taking it in. And the barber said, can I help you? I said, yes. I was just visiting with Roy Smith over in Pioneer, and he told me it's Wednesday, and Ray, I can't remember what I called him, was it Jenkins? But so Ray is, he's at the barbershop, and he's only open on Wednesday, and if you go over there, he knows everything about the area. And he said, oh, really? Is that what Roy said? I said, yep. He said, you know everything about this area, the history and who did what when. And he said, well, I know a little bit. And so I just kind of made myself at home. I started looking at the pictures on the wall, and I said, do you mind if I take some pictures? And he said, well, sure. I mean, if you want to take pictures, take pictures. So I took pictures, and I'll share those with you of the town. And then I sat down for a little while, and one man got out of the barber chair, and another man came in, another man got in the chair, and I just heard all kinds of things about the area from the people that lived there. And when I told him about Judy's dream, the barber, he's like, well, that's definitely, that's a new one. And I asked him how many people live there. And he said, about 800. He said, now back in the day, there were about 10,000, 15,000 in the boom time. Might have even been more. I don't remember now, and I didn't write everything down. I took a few notes. Now, there are a few things that I want to say about the barbershop. It was a slice of history. It was like you walked into a barbershop the way it might have looked in 1920 or 1940, maybe even 1960. It had a little of all of these eras. It definitely did not look modern at all. There was an old Coke machine, and I don't think the Coke machine was working. I think it was just a piece of nostalgia there. But it was just, it was crazy old. Now, I heard the story of why Ray was only open one day a week. I asked him that. And he said, well, I sold it. Back in 2016, I sold it to a man who wanted a business. And he said, within 6 months, he had chased off all the customers just by being mean and rude and ornery, and nobody liked him. And he said, the man who bought the business, he came back to me and he said, well, it's not working out and I don't want to do it anymore. Can you take over? And now I didn't ask him about the, particulars of the deal. Did he buy the business back or did the other guy still own it? And he just goes in. But the bottom line is that he just cuts hair. He said, I wanted to be retired, but I open up on Wednesday and I cut hair all day long and I just do the best I can. So he is still providing the service of haircuts in that small town, but he just does it one day a week. And he said, so I'm trying to be retired. And I said, well, one day a week is that's pretty retired. But it was the spot for the men. If the women had their quilting club, the men in the area have the barber shop. And I, at one point, there were about six. There was a bench that ran the length of the little shop. And at one point, when there were about six men in there, I said, well, you're pretty busy. And he said, oh, this is nothing. You should see it. He said, some Wednesdays, for most of the day, that whole bench is just full of men. And there's, a couple or three standing around. Now, one of the things that was so interesting to me about my time in the barbershop was that nobody was looking at their cell phone. In fact, there was no cell phones. And nobody was looking at a screen. And I just thought that was really interesting. And at one point when I was asking about what the place was like, during the boom time and that Roy over in Pioneer had mentioned all these different ruins and stuff, they said, well, if you want to see ruins, and one guy actually got his phone out and he looked up a map and then he got zoomed in, and he showed me over here is where there was an old college and there's some ruins there, and that was probably back in the 1930s. And he showed me that on his phone, and then he put his phone away. And that I also forgot to tell you that Roy Smith, the Scottish man and pioneer, he got his phone out to show me the pictures of the area. And he also sent me some pictures of that area. And so I thought that was pretty nice of him to do that, but he did. And so that was crazy. They told me where I could go and what other things I could look at. And they told me about Higginbotham's. And Higginbotham's was the hardware store across the street. And one of the men said, well, I grew up here, and this guy was probably 70 if he was a minute, maybe older. And he said that Higginbotham's it had everything, and it was lined up birth to death. So when you walked in the hardware store, they had the cradles and the playpens and the children's toys and clothes. And then it just got older and older as you went through the store. So they had the things for the school-age children, and they had the section for the cooking and the homemaking and that kind of thing. And he said then by the time he got to the other end of the store, they had the mortuary. And they had the different rooms like you would get at a funeral home, so that if there was more than one person that was having a funeral that day, there were like three or four little rooms that you could have the casket in and the family could have viewing. And he said, those rooms are still there. You'll see it if you walk in the store. And I did. I went to Higginbotham's. And it's a nice hardware store with modern, nice implements. And he said, well, a lot of people would prefer to shop here than drive over. And he told me the next town where they had the Home Depot. And, you know, he said, so, but you'll see at the far end, you'll those rooms that were the funeral homes, those are still there. They use them for other things. And sure enough, they were there. They had all their tools and saws and feed and you name it, whatever you'd need in a hardware store. And then down at the end was the funeral home that now had different kinds of hardware in it. But I'll go back to the barbershop for a little bit. So they were very nice men, and I was there for a good half hour, but it was kind of one of those things where I knew that they were being awfully nice to me, and I didn't want to overstay, but I was certainly enjoying hearing all of the stories that they were willing to tell me. Now, at one point, this guy walked in. He looked a little different than everybody else in the town. You know, they had their jeans on, and a couple of them had cowboy boots on and a big belt buckle, but nothing fancy. But this one fellow walked in, and I'd say he was in his 60s, but he had that look. I'm going to try to describe him and see if I can evoke the look for you in your minds. First of all, I'll give him a label. I'll say that he really struck me as that kind of beach bum that you might see in a place like San Diego, or I don't know if you even know the type, you know, hung out at a lot of Jimmy Buffett concerts, but... And I don't mean that, you know, in a bad way. I'm just trying to give you the image of him, because he came in not in a pair of blue jeans or scruffy boots, not with his hair done. This was not a guy that went to the barber shop to get his hair cut. He was there on other business or just hanging out and visiting. He had long hair and a beard that didn't get trimmed very often. And he had a ball cap on, and he had shorts and a t-shirt. This was not the attire in the town. But he was a local. And so at a certain point early on in my little visit to the barbershop, I said, what's the industry in this town? And that guy that I just described to you said, meth. And a couple of them laughed. And then when the barber said, well, sadly, it's probably closer to the truth than any of us want to admit. And, there was some other joke about him being at the barbershop to collect money. So, there's a little element of, what's happening here? But then he left, and then he came back a little bit later, and then he, you know, it's hard to describe him, but, you know, let's just say... definitely amped up. He had a bit of energy for somebody in deep into his 60s wearing his beach guy attire. There was two really nice fellows that were on the bench that I talked to for a long time. The one that showed me the map of with the ruins of the college, and he said, you know, I've lived in the big city. You can keep the big city. I've lived in a, you know, town of 2 million, and the pace of it, I don't need it. I hang out at my house. I've got my cats, and I spend a lot of time with the neighbor lady, and we visit, and that's good. He goes, sometimes I don't even come into town for 3 or 4 days. I don't need it, you know. So there was another old fellow down at the end of the bench. He had come in with a cigar that was not lit, that he was just chomping on the whole time. And he said, "Who's your neighbor? I forgot who lives next to you." And he goes, "Oh, Mary Watson." That was in the graveyard. It wasn't Mary Watson, but I made up a last name, and Watson will do. So he goes, "Oh, Mary Watson." And cigar chomping guy said, "Well, how is Mary? She wasn't in church Sunday. Is she okay?" And so the fellow said, "Yeah, she's fine. She wasn't really feeling great, so she just decided not to go to church." But I thought, so this is interesting. This is a town of 800, and they all know each other. And I was there, you know, maybe half an hour, but long enough to hear a story about the newspaper that was down the block. That was locked. That was closed. They sent me over to see the lady that ran the newspaper, but she wasn't around. And to tell me about Higginbothans. And they had all grown up there. The barber, who was probably 75 or so, he had, you know, born and raised. His dad was from the area. His granddad was from the area. They'd been there in the boom time, and they'd been there for the bust. And I mentioned to the barber that I had seen three Pentecostal churches between Pioneer and Cross Plains, and I said, I don't see Pentecostal churches in my county. And it's just interesting. He said there's a lot of those, I call them the Holy Roller churches. And I've heard them called Holy Roller churches before, because it's the whole idea is that you are baptized in the Holy Spirit and you are given gifts, spiritual gifts, speaking in tongues. You might have seen that or heard that, and other laying on of hands. And Alan told me about a woman, I think she was out of L.A., early 20th century, named Amy Simple McPherson, I think was her name, but she was quite a character. And a lot of crazy things that went on. I'm sure there was some sincere things, but the whole charismatic idea. And Alan said that a big thing with these Pentecostal revival kind of tent meeting baptized by the Holy Spirit was that there was a lot of hypnotism, even mass hypnotism or power of suggestion that went on. So you might have say a young boy that was crippled with polio or something, and they'd get him up on the stage and they might do enough crude mesmerism or hypnosis that he would be able to walk without the crutches for a very short period of time, and then the congregation goes crazy, but the hypnosis wears off, and indeed the young boy is still crippled. But anyway, that's just one example of the whole Pentecostal thing, but there were quite a few churches in that area. And they told me about, you know, I could tell they just were wondering, you know, but really, who are you? And the dream story, as funky and far out as it was, I'm not sure they bought it. And so it kind of led into one of them saying, well, you know, somebody was out here from Channel 4 one time, and he was making a thing. Do you remember what was the name of his show? It was like he had a kayak. Maybe that was part of the show. It was like, you know, man and kayak, and they go around and film it. And he made these little things. He put them up, and he said he didn't do a very good job, though. And one of the other guys said, oh, it was okay. He just missed a lot of the important stuff, and he needed a tour guide. That's what they all agreed, was that the fellow that came in with the film crew and the kayak, he needed a guide, and he would have done a better job. And then at some point, as I was getting ready to leave, I said, would it be okay if I took some pictures of you? And one of the men looked at me and he goes, Why on earth would you want to take a picture of us? We're ugly. And I said, well, I've had a really nice time here. I've had a good time talking to you, and you've been very hospitable. And, you know, it's a strange little mission I'm on here, and I just like to remember the day. And so one of the guys piped up, and he said, well, you're welcome to take my picture, but don't put it up on YouTube. So now I haven't told him anything about me except for my husband died and my friend had a dream. And I'm on a road trip to see Pioneer, and I ended up in Cross Plains because Roy told me to go there. And I said, oh, I wouldn't put it up on YouTube. And they said, well, sure, take our picture. And I did. But I'm not going to share it because I told them I wouldn't. But I can share some other things about the barbershop. I think that's okay as long as I keep their picture off of there. So I had a good visit at the barbershop. There's one last little thing there. There was a picture of a man. It looked like it was from the 1930s. It was really a painting. And he had a kind of fedora hat on, I guess it was. But anyway, he had a suit and tie. And I pointed to the picture of the man, and I said, as I was taking a photograph of the picture, I said, who is that? And I don't know if it was the barber or one of the others, said, oh, that's Robert E. Howard. That's Conan the Barbarian writer. I said, really? And he goes, yeah, he died in Cross Plains, and he lived here most of his life. I said, well, I'll be. So I took his picture, and here it is, you know, 2 weeks after my little road trip, and I never got around to looking up Robert E. Howard. Robert Irvin Howard was born January 22, 1906, and he died June 11, 1936. He was an American writer who wrote pulp fiction in a diverse range of genres. He created the character Conan the Barbarian and is regarded as the father of the sword and sorcery subgenre. Sword and sorcery is heroic fantasy characterized by sword-wielding heroes engaged in exciting and violent adventures. Elements of romance, magic, and the supernatural are also often present. Howard was born and raised in Texas. He spent most of his life in the town of Cross Plains, with some time spent in nearby Brownwood. A bookish and intellectual child, he was also a fan of boxing, eventually taking up amateur boxing. He also spent some time in his late teens bodybuilding. From the age of 9, he longed to become a writer of adventure fiction, but he did not have real success until he was 23. Thereafter, until his death by suicide at age 30, Howard's writings were published in a wide selection of magazines, journals, and newspapers, and he became proficient in several subgenres. His greatest success occurred after his death. Although a Conan novel was nearly published in 1934, Howard's stories were never collected during his lifetime. The main outlet for his stories was Weird Tales, where Howard created Conan the Barbarian. With Conan and his other heroes, Howard helped fashion the genre now known as sword and sorcery, spawning many imitators and giving him a large influence in the fantasy field. Howard remains a highly read author, with his best work still reprinted, and is one of the best-selling fantasy writers of all time. Howard's suicide and the circumstances surrounding it have led to speculation about his mental health. His mother had been ill with tuberculosis her entire life. Upon learning that she had entered a coma from which she was not expected to wake, he walked out to his car, parked outside his kitchen window, and shot himself in the head while sitting in the driver's seat. He died 8 hours later. And I will just say that I won't be able to post this on YouTube if I leave that in there. So I will just say that he put an end to himself, or I don't even think that that's okay. I don't think I can say the S word. So help. I don't know. So I'll just say, I'll just edit that out for the YouTube, because they'll come to me and ask me if I need counseling. So he was born in Peaster, Texas, the only son of a traveling country physician, Dr. Isaac Mordecai Howard, and his wife, Hester Jane Irvin Howard. His early life was spent wandering through a variety of Texas cow towns and boom towns. Dark Valley, Seminole, Poteet, Oran, Wichita Falls, Bagwell, Crosscut, and Burkett. During his youth, his parents' relationship began to break down. The Howard family had problems with money, which might have been exacerbated by Isaac Howard investing in get-rich-quick schemes. Hester Howard, meanwhile, came to believe that she had married below herself, so the pair were actively fighting. Hester did not want Isaac to have anything to do with their son. She had a particularly strong influence on her son's intellectual growth. She spent her early years helping a variety of sick relatives, contracting tuberculosis in the process. She instilled in her son a deep love of poetry and literature, recited verse daily, and supported him unceasingly in his efforts to write. Although he loved reading and learning, he found school to be confining, and he began to hate having anyone in authority over him. Experiences watching and confronting bullies revealed the omnipresence of evil and enemies in the world and taught him the value of physical strength and violence. As the son of the local doctor, Howard had frequent exposure to the effects of injury and violence due to accidents on farms and oil fields, combined with the massive increase in crime that came with the oil boom. First-hand tales of gunfights, lynchings, feuds, and Indian raids developed his distinctly Texan, hard-boiled outlook on the world. Sports, especially boxing, became a passionate preoccupation. So he was a voracious reader. He read a lot of historical fiction. He began at the age of 9 to write historical fiction, centering on Vikings, Arabs, battles, bloodshed. He would later be influenced by Jack London and Jack London's stories of reincarnation and past lives, most notably The Star Rover, and Rudyard Kipling's tales of subcontinent adventures. So in 1919, and this would have been when he was 13, I guess, the family moved to Cross Plains, and that's where they would stay for the rest of Howard's life. Howard's father, and there's a picture I'll share of the Robert E. Howard Museum in Cross Plains, Texas. Howard's father bought a house in the town with a cash down payment and made extensive renovations. That same year, sitting in a library in New Orleans while his father took medical courses at a nearby college, Howard discovered a book concerned with the scant fact and abundant legends surrounding an indigenous culture in ancient Scotland called the Picts. Now, it goes on. I'll share you this wiki page, and you can look at it. But when I was looking at that today, I thought, isn't that interesting? Because Alan was also interested in the Picts. And here you go. In 1930, with his interest in Solomon Kane dwindling, this is a Solomon Cain as a sword and sorcery, so his interest in that is dwindling. And his cull stories were not catching on. Howard applied his new sword and sorcery and horror experience to one of his first loves, the Picts. His story, Kings of the Night, depicted King Cull conjured into pre-Christian Britain to aid the Picts in their struggle against the invading Romans, and introduced readers to Howard's King of the Picts, Bran Mac Mom. I find that interesting. There might be something there. I'll have to explore that more. I went back to the little area before Pioneer to where Roy lived, Roy Smith. And I drove down to the end and I saw his grandmother's house and I got out. I didn't walk too far back because of the copperheads. And I looked around a little bit. Took a few pictures of the house. I'll share those with you. And then I got in my car and I later on saw that when I got home, I saw that he had sent me these pictures of the old oil derrick and so forth. And I thanked him for that. I said I really appreciated that. And he was just very, very nice. He said, I wrote him and I said, thank you so much. I had a nice visit at Ray's shop with everyone there waiting for a haircut. And he wrote back and said, yes, ma'am. Next time you come this way, let me know ahead of time and we'll have a nice dinner prepared and show you the old oil field ruins that are left on the land. That'll be his land. And see if we can find you a few more stories to share. Tell me your name once again. I should have put it in my phone. And I told him my name once again, first and last. And then I said, that is so nice. Thank you. I am going to accept the invitation and I will check back with you later in the spring. Thank you again. And I will. I was thinking about Judy's dream and my adventure and how I went there and I didn't know the point of it. And I thought, you know, at the very beginning when Roy said, I hope you find what you're looking for, I wondered, what was it that I was looking for? Was it just an adventure? Was it a day away? I never did tell Betty. Judy said, well, you'll have to tell Betty what you're up to or take her with. And I said, oh, she would never understand. She would wonder why I wasn't over there helping her clean out her garage. And the whole thing would just be too weird for her to understand. But on my way out of town, I was getting kind of hungry. And I left the area and I'm driving down the highway and I don't really see anything. I didn't want to stop at one of these chain places. And I kept, you know, passing chain kind of restaurants. And I finally saw a sign. It was called New York Hill. And I said, New York Hill, exit in 5 miles. And so I did. And it was a restaurant on top of the hill, and you could see, you know, for a long distance. And I asked the waitress what I should have, and she said I should have a hamburger. And I got a hamburger and fries, and I've got to tell you, that's one of the best hamburgers I've ever had, and one of the best plate of fries that I've ever had, too. It was really good. And while I was sitting there eating the hamburger and fries, I thought, well, maybe I'm supposed to go back to Pioneer three times or two more times. I mean, Alan told Judy and her mother in the dream that he was going to Pioneer, Texas, and he was going to be there for 3 days. So maybe I'm supposed to go to Pioneer, Texas 3 days. maybe I have, you know, what it is I'm supposed to discover, I don't know until I've been to the area 3 times. But I am going back. I'm going to have dinner at Ray's house, and I'm going to walk around his land with him, and I'm bringing some high-top boots with me, the Wellingtons, I think, that the Copperhead won't get through. And let him show me those oil field ruins. And it'll be fun. Like he said, nobody in my whole lifetime has ever wanted to hear anything about Pioneer, Texas. So I don't normally do this, but I am making this little addendum for you because I recorded the real history yesterday, and then last night I was thinking about Robert E. Howard, and I thought, you know, I just recorded that kind of off the cuff without doing any homework or reading or thinking about it, and I've never read his work. I've never read Conan the Barbarian, and I never saw the movie, and it was just an interesting thing that I had stumbled on. But when I was reading the wiki and saw his fascination, his early fascination with the Scottish Picts, this warring so-called indigenous tribe, it just got me thinking about a few things. So I listened to someone who had known him. He would have been a much younger boy. That he was a little bit mentored by Robert E. Howard. And the home that the writer grew up in ended up getting turned into a museum. I mentioned that. And this writer is walking, that this fellow is walking through the museum and talking about his experiences knowing the writer and how he too had wanted to be a writer when he grew up and how kind that Robert E. Howard was to him and helpful, and he even did actually help him with some, you know, kind of writing assistance things. So I had also listened last night to a talk that a Texas author did. He wrote a biography on him, and I didn't pull that up before I started recording this, but I think the name of that biography was called Blood and Thunder, something like that. But he made some really good, interesting points, and it's entertaining, and I will link to both of these videos that I'm talking about. This Texas-based biographer said that even though Robert E. Howard is very little known, and that the movie Conan the Barbarian certainly eclipsed the novel or the short stories that he had written featuring Conan, he said that he had a major influence on a lot of things that we take for granted now, including games that many of you might have grown up with, such as Dungeons and Dragons. And also he talked about the impact that it had on even video games, and that, you know, so there's an impact that the writer, this is the case that he's making, the biographer, that his reach, his scope was much more than just writing some fantasy fiction. But again, what struck me was what I heard from several different people that just kind of reminded me in a way of Alan, which was he was a bookish boy, and Alan was athletic too, and Robert E. Howard seemed to devote himself to different kinds of physical activity, but he loved books and he read widely. And I, you know, read the part there in Wiki where his mother encouraged his love of literature and his love of poetry, but according to this one old fellow who was walking through the museum, his father also encouraged that as well. Even though the family ended up breaking up, this man remembered his father saying when, you know, Robert E. Howard would have been pretty young, he said, well, he's cleaned that library out. We've got to go a little further afield and find him more books. He wants more books. And it was kind of a joke that he just read the local libraries out and they'd have to go find him more books to read. And he knew at the age of 9, and he was already writing short stories then, that this is what he wanted to do. And I made some parallels in my own mind. Yes, Robert E. Howard wanted to kind of address his life there in the sticks in Boomtown, what was an oil boomtown, but mostly the sticks of Texas at that time, that he saw brutality and evil. He called it evil, man against man. And I think maybe he was making an escape for himself and for other people through entertainment. And he was a voracious reader and consumer of anything about history that he could get his hands on. And I saw that parallel with Alan. And, of course, the direction that Alan went with it was not to entertain us, but to educate us and encourage us to think about these things for ourselves. But it was that bit in Wiki where it described his fascination with the Scottish Picts and the fact that there was scant factual information about them, but just stacks of legend around them. So the Picts, even for those of you who don't study history, might have seen the popular depiction of the Picts, where they're painted in blue body paint, essentially. And they could be covered in tattoos. Of course, all of this is just a contemporary, the artist's depiction of what they might have looked like, because there's a lot of disagreement about them. And so I wanted to address that. This isn't going to turn into a talk about the Picts, but just a couple of little things to think about, because Alan thought about them too. And the name Pict comes from the Latin picti, which is, I guess, just pictures, because they were covered in paint. And there is some disagreement whether it was body paint that they put on for warring battle or if these were actual tattoos, but they were covered in them, and that they made use of blue, or they were described as being blue. And this is thought to come from a plant. I didn't look up the Latin name for it, but or the Greek name for it, or anything, so I don't have a genus name for it, but woad is a blue dye that comes from a plant, and so that's what, I guess that is around the area of northern Scotland where they were found. The, what's his name, Bede, he was a historian who wrote, he was a monk historian, and he wrote a medieval ecclesiastical history of England, and he described the Picts as being Scythian, which is Iranian steppe peoples from, I don't know, maybe 8,000 BC that had left Iran and gone to the steppes of Asia and what would now be modern, like Moldova, Ukraine, Russia. And that there are other historians who think that they were just a local indigenous people. But when you study the Picts, you get a lot of clues that they were different. They were very skilled metal workers. A lot of these standing stones that you see, Alan showed me a lot of the roundhouse constructions where people lived in these round houses, the stone houses with the thatched roof. And those are Pictish dwellings, and the carvings on the stones were quite elaborate and unique and very stylized. So if it was depicting an animal, it was quite stylized. And so the historians refer to the Picts as the Pictish problem, but these were the Scottish men, we'll just call them Scottish now, who fought off the Romans. So you can understand why a writer like Robert E. Howard would be fascinated by them, and I can also understand why Alan was too. I noticed that there was a bit of study around them and the DNA discoveries. They said that they had done the complete genome of eight remains, eight full human remains that they had uncovered from a Pictish cemetery, and that they had determined that they were indigenous, they were local. But I just don't think that we can know. I mean, first of all, eight bodies is not very many, and even a small cemetery can have a lot of people buried in it that aren't necessarily Pictish. And, you know, when were those people? I didn't read the study, but, you know, when were they buried there? How much assimilation had there been? So I think that the Pictish problem or the mystery of the Picts is one that we might have to live with, just as there is so much in history that we can't really know, especially when we're going back ancient. But it did make me think, you know, Alan had overcome for himself a lot of the national identity. He really understood how peoples and are created and given an identity and given foundational myths, and that this is part of culture creation. And so he was the big picture thinker. And he was not going to be stuck in a national problem or a national identity like Scottish independence or something like that. You know, that just wasn't for him. And he had left Scotland as a young man. But I know, and I'm just sharing this with you because this little adventure of mine brought this up, I know that Alan, even though he wouldn't say it out loud, I know that he loved being Scottish. And I know that he thought that there was something special about being Scottish. Again, he would not have said that. So I'm just going to take us once more back to the cemetery. I don't know why, but when I was in the cemetery first with you, I did not share this. So I saw that first grave. It was a Watson. And then later on, I found the one Watts stone in the cemetery. But there was something that I noticed, and that was that there were several, quite a handful, of Buchanans. And Buchanan is Clan Buchanan. And so the clan is the affiliation of many different families. I think under the Buchanans there might be, I mean, Alan told me this once or twice, but I didn't retain it perfectly, but the Buchanans would have maybe 50 or more families in the clan, Watt being one of them. So I will leave you with those few things to think about, and I'll be sure to remember to give you some videos that you can watch if you're interested in Robert E. Howard. And now I'll continue with the rest that I had already recorded. And that's that. So I got back home and I told my brother about my adventure, and he said, "Oh, that reminds me of something he had watched, you know, years ago when he was young." He said it was Four Country Reporter, Channel 4 Country Reporter, something, or Texas Country Reporter, you know. And he even knew, he remembered the theme song for it. And he goes, "Yeah, it was this reporter, and he just went around to all over West Texas, and he just did shows of weird towns, small towns, and stuff like that." I was looking at it up, and I guess they covered Terry Gooley, an ice sculptor in Midland, who used a chainsaw and chisels to create these ice sculptures for special occasions. And there was Ryan Smith. He was a law school dropout who returned to the drive-in theater in Lubbock. And in 1948, his grandfather had opened that also at the age of 25. And so he ran that for his life. And so it's just like meeting people and covering them and, you know, doing footage of it. He goes, yeah, you could do that. And I said, well, you know something? I had such a good time that I feel like I could go on a road trip once a month just to some odd place, you know, just within a, like about a 100-150 mile radius. That would be about it, because I wouldn't want to spend the night anywhere. Just do a little day trip, get up early in the morning and go. And we laughed about it. I said, now I've got plenty to do to keep me busy. I don't need to be the new four country reporter. So like I, you know, like Roy said, I hope you find what you're looking for. I don't know if I did, and I don't know if this was an interesting story for you, but that's what I did on April the 2nd, 2025. And when I go back to Pioneer, Texas, I'll see if I can talk the guys in the barbershop into actually letting me take a picture of them that I can put up on YouTube. I hope that you all have a really good week. Thank you for listening. And take care of yourselves and stop and smell the roses. Have a little bit of wonder. Have some time to do something different. Take care.
Well, I've got something that the world didn't give me, and the world cannot take it. And I've got something that the world didn't give me, and the world cannot take it away. Well, it is love, sweet love, oh, sent to me from my Father up above.